This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Dozens of migrants trying to reach the UK from France have drowned after their small boat capsized in the Channel. An air and sea rescue operation is underway, but authorities say with at least 31 people dead, it's the worst disaster on record involving migrants in the water separating the countries. Our Europe correspondent is Isabella Higgins. Isabella, who spotted this boat?
Well, Sabra, it was actually a local French fisherman who raised the alarm when he spotted an overturned dinghy. Now, of course, we know that that boat had likely come from the French coast, likely organised by people smugglers, filled with migrants trying to make their way to the UK to seek asylum. So after that alarm was raised, French authorities got involved. They found dozens and dozens of people who had died. They did manage to take a number to hospital. Sadly, in those who died, there was a number of women and also a young girl. Now, already we've heard this described as an absolute tragedy. We had the French Maritime Authority say that this was one of the worst migrant deaths they had ever seen in the English Channel. Just a short time ago, we heard from the French Interior Minister, who offered his condolences to the victims and to the families, but also denounced the work of people smugglers. And we've also heard from the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who had a very similar message.
I'm shocked and appalled and deeply saddened by the loss of life at sea in the Channel. My thoughts and sympathies are, first of all, with the victims and their families. But I also want to say that this disaster underscores how dangerous it is to cross the Channel in this way.
Isabella, the UK has been adopting an Australian-style turn back the boat operation. Does this tragedy mean that that's not working?
Well, it's been a very, very big issue here, Sabra. That's because there's been 25,000 people who've made their way to the UK by boat via the English Channel, and that figure is three times what it was last year. So this is an escalating problem. So we've heard a lot about this in recent days, weeks and months. Boris Johnson himself has said that likely this isn't working, that those tougher border operations that they've put in place so far aren't doing enough.
Gangs who are sending people to sea in these dangerous craft will literally stop at nothing unless they are shown that their business model won't work, that they can't simply get people over the Channel from France to the UK. They will continue to deceive people, to put people's lives at risk, and as I say, to get away with murder.
So we can expect that the UK will likely put pressure on the French government now to do more. This issue is already an ongoing source of tension. The UK feel that the French should be doing more to stop those boats from leaving their shores. And of course, the French say that they're doing absolutely everything possible. So we can expect more rules and regulations likely from the UK on this issue and perhaps some further diplomatic tensions between the UK and France on this issue.
That's our Europe correspondent, Isabella Higgins. 2 months after the election in Germany, a new government's finally been formed, and one of its top priorities is accelerating the phasing out of coal, with a target of doing that by 2030. The coalition government will be made up of the Social Democrats, led by Olaf Scholz, who will replace Angela Merkel as Chancellor, along with the Greens and the pro-business party, the Free Democrats. The new government is also hoping to expand the take-up of electric cars, as Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
Grüne und FDP haben sich in den Verhandlungen auf einen gemeinsamen Koalitionsvertrag verständigt.
It took around 300 negotiators and just on 2 months for the Social Democrats to strike a deal with its new coalition partners, the Greens and the Free Democrats. And the Chancellor-in-waiting, Olaf Scholz, is already making a point of difference from his predecessor, Angela Merkel, over climate change policy. Ms. Merkel set a target of 2038 to phase out coal. The new coalition wants to bring that forward to 2030. They also have a plan to have 15 million electric cars on German roads by the end of the decade.
With ambition and perseverance, we will make our country a pioneer in climate protection, with the consistent and speedy expansion of renewable energies, with an acceleration of planning law, we will support industry in switching to climate-neutral production. Cutting-edge technology made in Germany will continue to exist in the future.
The Greens leader, Annalena Baerbock, is expected to be appointed Germany's first female foreign minister and has signalled a tougher stance on Russia. The coalition agreement demands an immediate end to attempts to destabilise Ukraine and the illegal annexation of Crimea. Olaf Scholz has also made it clear that a new coalition government would strengthen the European Union and the role it plays in maintaining what he calls a sovereign Europe.
We're not the ones standing on the sides sending off comments. We're the ones who want to help create a strong, sovereign Europe. We feel closely tied to the transatlantic partnership, and cooperation with the United States is of vital importance to the future government.
There will be many challenges facing the new three-party coalition, including dealing with such disparate views on policy, and succeeding Angela Merkel, who remains popular despite being Chancellor for 16 years. But in the immediate term, there's the pressing issue of soaring COVID rates and whether the country needs to go into lockdown or adopt mandatory vaccination like its neighbour, Austria. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
Widespread rain and floodings destroyed crops and interrupted harvesting right across the country during what was supposed to be a bumper season. While farming is pretty risky, what makes events like the current one more damaging is that there are no options for growers to insure themselves against these losses. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The losses are significant and not over yet.
These recent events, right from the first one, but the second and now the third, are compounding the damage and expanding the area statewide that's suffering the damage.
Xavier Martin's the Vice President of New South Wales Farmers.
Certainly the majority of the wheat is right in that susceptible zone. You know, it's going to be at high risk of downgrading, and much of it, depending on whether it's bread wheat or durum wheat, is in prospect of losing between 30 and 60% of its value because of the downgrading in quality.
He farms on the Liverpool Plains near Gunnedah. Like most of his peers in New South Wales and others across the country, his crops aren't sodden and unable to be harvested until the rain and flooding clears.
Look, my approach now will be very much about not damaging the landscape and the paddocks too much, you know, in terms of bogging and damage of equipment. There's not a lot can be done in terms of saving quality. Yeah, it's just one of those things that a lot of people are in the same basket.
Grain growers are going to have to wear these crop losses and the drop in value because insurance against events like this is virtually non-existent.
You can get hail and fire, but not wet weather, no. Australia actually doesn't have that product. We're one of the few developed countries that doesn't have a multi-peril income protection product.
Tracy Blackburn's a mixed farmer just west of Dubbo. Insurers in Australia don't offer this product because the market's small and agriculture is, by nature, risky. US farmers can get multi-peril insurance, but it's government subsidised. In Australia, one idea is that farmers could invest a small amount each year to cover some of their losses.
You're not there to make money out of it. Its basis is so that you cover your costs. So you just go, right, we can saddle up, we can pay back to our ag suppliers, we can pay our wages, we can pay our fuel bills, we can keep the bank happy, and then you can roll for another year.
What Tracy Blackburn and other advocates want is an initial loan from the federal government to cover any shortfall that could then be paid back once there's a surplus, though Agriculture Minister David Littleproud has previously indicated it's not something he'd be willing to support. If there were some sort of insurance, Xavier Martin reckons there'd be interest, particularly after years like this.
Oh, there's absolutely an appetite. I've lost count of how many farmers I've spoken to can see the merit of it as it, in terms of commercialising that risk, but at a wholesale pricing, not at the retail pricing we have to pay at the moment.
However, without government backing, it's not likely to be feasible.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. Almost 3 years ago, a project began in the sand plains and mulga scrubs of southwestern Queensland to boost the number of bilbies. Six of the endangered marsupials were released into a fenced area of a national park to keep them away from feral cats, foxes and wild dogs. The idea was to increase the population and then eventually release them out into the wild. But as Ellie Grounds reports, the animals seem to have made their own head start on that.
It was a night I'll never, ever forget.
6 months ago on Budgety Country in remote southwest Queensland, Kevin Bradley was checking on the bilby population that lives in a fenced-off area in Currawinya National Park. After midnight, the CEO of the Save the Bilby Fund charity spotted something that he'd never seen in his 20 years of trying to save the tiny creature.
I saw this little animal skipping along the side of the road, and I couldn't believe my eyes and was positive that I was imagining things or hallucinating through sleep deprivation or something, and then knew, of course, what it was.
It was a bilby outside the fence.
With the exception of the animals that we've released, I've never seen a wild animal, so it was pretty incredible. My skin was on fire and I was beside myself with excitement.
The original population of six bilbies inside the enclosure has grown to over 200, and it was always the plan to eventually allow the marsupials to live and breed outside the fence. But it appears the bilbies might have become tired of waiting.
I think it's fantastic. I think that it's maybe a little sooner than planned, but I think that's a good thing in a way, because while there's so much effort around the fence because we've got that population on the inside, I think it makes sense to start applying that to the outside.
Cassandra Arkenstall is a PhD candidate at the University of Queensland and a volunteer with the Save the Bilby Fund.
If, for instance, there was a colony of bilbies right up close to the fence, it is possible that a bilby was pressured out, and that might have been just the kick that it needed to get it up and over the fence.
The pair took to the skies in a helicopter looking for signs of more wild animals and followed up with a ground survey where they discovered recently used burrows, feed scrapes and droppings.
And so then it was about putting some traps out. So put a burrow trap on a really active looking burrow, and we managed to catch a female. I was able to take ear tissue from this wild bilby. The idea is to compare that to the DNA of the individuals inside the fence to see if she's related to them.
With signs there are multiple bilbies now outside the fence, Kevin Bradley is now speeding up his plan to try and eradicate their number one enemy, the feral cat, from outside the enclosure as well.
Yeah, the game begins. Now the real work starts, trying to keep those animals surviving in the wild and hopefully proliferating in the wild.
Yeah, hopefully. Kevin Bradley there from the Save the Bilby Fund, ending that report from Ellie Grounds. Hezbollah has strongly condemned Australia's announcement that it'll list both military and political wings of the Lebanese Shia militant group as terrorist organisations. Australia's move brings it into line with more than a dozen other countries, including the US, UK and Canada. But as Lebanon spirals into a deepening economic crisis, experts say the decision could have consequences for the rest of the region. Middle East correspondent Tom Joyner reports.
In this Beirut neighbourhood, many struggle to remember a time when Hezbollah wasn't a part of daily life in Lebanon.
As a Lebanese, I mean, in the end, like it or not, they're part of the Lebanese community, and they're not like strangers who came in and settled in Lebanon.
To its supporters, Hezbollah, the Shiite militant group and political party, provides social security, bolsters military strength, and boasts 13 MPs in the Lebanese government. But Australia has now joined a growing list of countries that views the entire Hezbollah organisation as a terrorist group.
Well, it's obvious there's a clear consolidation of that anti-Hezbollah mood, if you want, in the world. And now Australia joins that same list.
Dr. Karim El-Mufti is a political scientist at St. Joseph's University in Beirut.
Here Australia is taking a stand. And so this political stand will obviously affect Lebanon as a whole, because Hezbollah is a part of the government. It's part of the entire structure today. But it's yet to be seen if this actually affects official bilateral relations between Canberra and Beirut.
In a statement, Hezbollah says it strongly disapproves of Australia's decision and considers it to be triggered by the United States to serve Israel's interests. Hezbollah has long been seen as a threat to Israel's national security, and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett tweeted his thanks to Scott Morrison for, quote, his leadership on the issue.
I think it's very significant news. Hezbollah is one of the arch enemies of Israel because it is the pivotal axis of the Iranian-backed Shiite militias in the area.
Yoram Schweitzer leads counter-terrorism research at the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. He says Australia's listing of Hezbollah as a terrorist organisation is part of a slow-building movement that will undermine the group.
As many other countries will join in, it will be better security-wise to these countries. I think it takes time to countries to understand it, but one after the other, they understand it's not an Israeli problem. It's a regional problem and it may turn into a global problem.
But back on the Beirut streets, not all are convinced much will really change.
There's too many sanctions on Hezbollah. There was no result. Every parties who suck the blood of Lebanon, the corruption. No one is innocent in Lebanon, include Hezbollah.
This is Tom Joyner in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Australia could be close to getting new laws which would make it easier for the federal government to slap sanctions on serious human rights abusers and criminals. The government's introduced legislation inspired by the so-called Magnitsky laws, which have been introduced in several Western countries. Human rights groups are on board, but are urgently pressing the government to make last-minute changes to toughen up the regime. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
In a London ballroom, applause rings out for Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian charity worker being handed a Magnitsky Human Rights Award. She couldn't accept it in person because she's in Iran, where she's been detained since 2016. Her family says she's a hostage being used to pressure the British government over a $750 million debt claimed by Iran. But her seven-year-old daughter, Gabriella, read out a message from her.
Thank you for this award. It means a lot to me and to my cellmates that we are not forgotten.
Nazanin's supporters are pressing the British government to use Magnitsky sanctions to target her jailers in Iran. The sanctions are named after Russian lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, who uncovered large-scale tax fraud and died in prison after giving evidence against corrupt officials. And in Canberra, legislation driven by the same coalition of human rights advocates is close to a reality. Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching, who also received an award at the same event and who's long championed Magnitsky sanctions in Australia, says the case for them is compelling.
Who wants to be on the side of human rights violators? Having them come to our country, own property, be here, take succour from our excellent rule of law. This is about standing up for our values.
The government introduced the legislation after MPs across the political spectrum pressed for action. And this legislation looks likely to pass with backing from Labor, although Senator Kitching wants it to cast a wider net.
Currently, it looks like it's only just really addressing bribery. But as we know, corruption of public officials particularly can be much broader than that.
Still, the new laws will allow the government to target cyber criminals. The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, says the proposed new laws will target threats to international peace and security, including malicious cyber activity, ensuring there are consequences for egregious behaviour in cyberspace. The Green Senator, Janet Rice, says her party will press for amendments to establish an independent advisory body which could recommend which human rights abusers should be targeted.
An independent advisory body essentially creates a really transparent process. It would be up to the government to decide whether to impose targeted sanctions, but it would mean that it wouldn't just be in the hands of the minister.
And Elaine Pearson from Human Rights Watch also wants the government to broaden the scope of the new sanctions regime.
Under the proposed bill, there's only three human rights that are covered. The right to life, the right to be free from torture, and the right to be free from slavery and forced labour. But there are other rights, for instance, the right to be free from arbitrary detention that are not covered.
But the window to make changes is narrow. Parliament rises next week and the government wants this legislation passed before the end of the year.
Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Boispierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Scott Morrison has just one more week to whip through his government's end-of-year parliamentary to-do list, with a religious discrimination bill, voter ID measures, and a federal anti-corruption body all on the agenda. So why is a group of the government's own MPs and senators getting in the way?
Today on The Signal, why the backbench is revolting and what it may mean for the election. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.